We are presently recording again, so...
Oh, okay. I'll be careful what I say.
Yeah, well, where were we? We were talking about your extended tour in France where you learned how to do organic synthesis and label compounds with deuterium, and that was a... after you finished your three-year stint in the Air Force.
Correct.
And now... We were talking about France and the attitude of the French toward Americans at that time. It was fairly favorable.
Yeah.
And any other interesting things that you had to observe about France at that particular time? And you want to share with us, or is that about it?
Well, that was my postdoc time.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is, what little French I know, I learned by going to lunch with the graduate students and eating in their cafeteria, which is pretty interesting. You know, they have an established meal, and you just go along and get a dollop of this and a dollop of that, and by and large it's pretty good. And you sit down in the cafeteria on more or less picnic benches, and there's carafes of wine brought to the table.
Wine?
White or red or both.
So wine was
a staple.
Drink of the day, soda or water, whatever.
Yeah, I think there was also water available. I think so. Anyway.
Probably everybody had wine, though.
Yeah. I don't think there was any abuse.
Well, it was lunch, and you had to go back to the lab.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. But anyway, that's wine is pretty well in. With a meal, it's not like Dick Cheney having only one beer before he goes out and shoots his buddy in the face.
Okay.
Oh, jeez. Oh, man.
As a hunter, I assume this probably resonates with you even more.
Yeah. Jeez. Oh, man.
By the way, before breakfast, we were talking about when you were an undergraduate, you did a summer, took a summer job abroad.
Oh, in Bavaria.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that again? We should have been recording that, but we were just about ready to sit down for breakfast.
Well, let's see. When I was in college at Iowa State, I was in a fraternity, and one of my fraternity brothers had joined an organization called the American Student Information Service, which was a euphemism for a commercial equivalent of a student exchange program, except that it was commercialized to the extent that you had to buy a membership. And if you bought a membership, this organization would try to find you employment somewhere in Europe for the summer. And my fraternity brother wanted me to do that, and I told him I couldn't because I had an obligation to work with my father during the summer harvesting bluegrass. And so my fraternity brother went ahead and joined the organization and had lined up a fairly cushy job at a resort somewhere on the Rhine, and continued to badger me and chide me a little bit for passing up the opportunity to spend time with him on the Rhine. And meanwhile, my father finally told me that we weren't going to do any bluegrass harvest that summer, and so I was suddenly free to do whatever I wanted for the summer. And so I went back to my fraternity brother, and we decided that I would write a letter to the American Student Information Service saying that I wanted to join the organization, provided that I was assigned to the same job that my fraternity brother had.
Okay, you wanted to stick together, be pals.
I wanted to continue, having my buddy with me, so to speak. So, fine, I sent the letter off. And about 6-7 weeks later, we each get a letter from the American Student Information Service saying that he and I were assigned to farm labor in southern Bavaria.
That sounds like an exciting activity.
Yeah. So my fraternity brother was not particularly excited about that, but accepted it. And so we went ahead and flew. At that time, we flew turboprop airplanes, which from LaGuardia stopped in Rybnik, Iceland, to refuel for a couple hours. And we finally got over, and we met other people on the airplane that were going over to Europe, and they were also ones that had arranged for a job in a resort, and were sort of chuckling at us who were assigned to farm labor, for crying out loud, like we were convicts.
Yeah.
So we landed over in Frankfurt, as I recall, and got on a train, went down to Munich, took another train to a small city in Bavaria called Traunstein.
Traunstein,
T-R-A-U-N, Stein.
Okay.
And our destination, however, was a village called Vagging, V-W-A-G-I-N-G, Amc, A-A-M.
Z.
Yeah, I think it was S-I, which means a village on the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And middle-aged man met us at the train station there in Vagging, who turned out to be the straw boss on the farm where we were going to work. And he took us to a tavern, promptly ordered a couple of steins of beer and a couple of glasses of whiskey. For a Boilermaker or whatever, So that was our introduction. Then he drove us out to the farmstead, and we went to bed for the night. I remember that the windows in the bedroom opened out with no screens, no windows, just shutters that opened out into the night. We were effectively in the foothills of the Bavarian Alps, living. And this farm was owned by an elderly gentleman who lived on the place. They had not only a barn, but a fairly big house for the main family. with the old man and his wife, and they had two daughters in their 20s or 30s. And one was married to the guy who picked us up at the train station, who turned out to be our straw boss. Mm-hmm. And also of note, this guy had been a captain in the German army, in the artillery, under General Rommel.
Wow. So he was stationed evidently in North Africa?
Africa, probably.
Wow.
But I and it turned out he was a very nice guy, and he loved Americans. And I'm not sure whether he'd spent some time in an American POW, but anyway, he had a good attitude toward us. So the farm...
Now the father, he says one of them had a kind of a Nazi...
So the old man had a... It was a... I don't know how to describe it, but he sort of looked like a Nazi, and B, he had sort of a stern look about him and an attitude, and he walked around the farm as we were working and make sure we were. He walked had a walking stick, and he had riding pants for horseback, and he wore a leather or a herringbone tweed sports coat and a typical German hat that you'd seen from Bavaria with the feathers in it and so forth. So the family in this house consisted of the old man and his wife, who was an older lady, and their two daughters, and the one of the daughters was married to the captain under Rommel, and he was our straw boss. And the young wife could speak a little bit of English, like open the window, close the door, sort of thing. And we spoke hardly any German. I mean, I sprach Klein Deutsch. I mean, that was a silly thing to say, but we tried to learn various phrases and various words every day, and we got along just fine. We worked hard. We worked 10 hours a day. Five days a week. And on Saturday, we could take a bath. And on Sunday, the family... The artillery captain and his wife and the two kids would take us on a Sunday drive. We'd drive up into the mountains, the Bavarian Alps, and go to various activities in the village. So we were part of the family. It was wonderful. My fraternity brother and I did lots of odd jobs, mostly things that no one else wanted to do, like clean the manure out of the barn. Mm-hmm. And just odd jobs around the place that needed to be done. We would do them.
But you ended up working basically pretty long days.
Yeah, so we'd work 10-hour days. And I'm among other things, this farm was a mixed bag of growing crops like wheat, hay. Possibly corn, but I don't remember. But they also had a truck garden, and among other things, sugar beets. And we had to go out and hoe the sugar beets, weed the sugar beets. And I remember that we had quite a bit of rain, and there was a lot of mud out there, so we were more or less hoeing the sugar beets in the mud. It was a mess. But didn't complain too much because everyone else was working hard, even the straw boss. And you couldn't complain too much in that beautiful country, but all you had to do is just look up from where you were hoeing the sugar beets, look across the valley at the Bavarian Alps, snow-covered. It was Sound of Music country. It was just gorgeous, just gorgeous. And we start working. We get up and have breakfast in the morning, go down to the main table in the main dining room, and the table had various loaves of bread, big plates of butter, bowls of jam, and that was breakfast. And you could have coffee. No bacon and eggs, just bread and butter and sweet jam stuff. Mm-hmm. I had trouble eating enough of that to keep me going till noon. But about 11 o'clock, we would come back into the house for lunch. And it wasn't lunch. It was a huge meal. There would be, at each of the place settings, there'd be a bowl of hot soup. And then there'd be a big trays of big plates of meat, like a big beef roast or a pot roast or a pork roast, and big bowls of potatoes and big bowls of gravy and vegetables of some sort, I suppose. I can't remember what. But it was a heavy meal. And about 1 o'clock, we'd go back to work, back out in the field. No dessert. Back in the field. And we'd work for a couple hours, and then about 3 o'clock, 3:30, we go back to the house, and the table was set with huge plates of cookies or cake or pie or strawberry shortcake. Just wonderful desserts. That would be middle of the afternoon. And we'd work till 7 o'clock at night. Then we'd go back to the house, wash up, go back into the big table with the whole family. And each place setting was a bowl of soup, but it was cold soup. And they would bring out big trays of sandwiches. It'd be two slices of bread and butter, or two slices of bread and cheese, or two slices of bread and salami, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it was a cold meal, mm-hmm. cold sandwiches, as opposed to the huge dinner that we had for lunch, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Quite different. And then we'd go to bed about 7 o'clock, 7:30, something like that. And we were pretty tired. I tell you, the first day they got us up at 7 o'clock after getting there the night before and having the beer and the whiskey with the straw boss. First day, we're up putting up green hay, which in this country we called silage. Mm-hmm. It was green hay that would be sent or winrowed into a shredder of sorts. They would chop this hay, green hay, up, and that would be put in some sort of silage to be fermented, to be fed to the cattle during the during the autumn and spring, or winter, I guess. That was tough work because it was all intertwined and like a mess of twine that had been tangled. It was not hay that was nice and fluffy and dry that you could move around easily. It wasn't baled. It was just a mess.
So how long was this tour of duty?
Yeah. So we were there for 4 or 6 months, I think.
Okay. But I mean, it was a summer job, right? So it could have been probably late May to August, something like that. And this is why you were in undergraduate school.
Yeah, I was still at Iowa State.
Yeah.
Yeah, I you know, I just don't remember.
Yeah.
But the order, we worked there for 3 or 4 months. As I recall.
Yeah.
Then I had a cousin who was on duty in the army, stationed in Germany, and he came by and offered to take us on a little tour of Europe, much to the chagrin of the old man and the straw boss who were depending on us to work in the harvest.
Yeah.
And so we did as much as we could with them, but they sympathized with us and let us go.
Well, that's nice of your cousin.
It was a wonderful experience living with his family and living in that small village. And in contrast, when we returned to the United States, of course, we went back to Stuttgart or wherever, or Frankfurt, I can't remember where, got back on the plane and met many of the same students that we had visited with on the way over from Iceland. And they were still kidding us about having to work on a farm and everything. But we asked them what they'd done. Well, they had worked in resorts all summer, waiting on tables filled with Americans.
Mm-hmm.
It was like they'd been working in St. Louis at some bar.
Yeah.
They had never set foot in a domestic household in Germany, had no contact with the German population. And in contrast, we had had this wonderful experience with a family.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept in touch with that family for many months. Wonderful experience.
Yes, all because of our fraternity brothers.
Yeah, he got over it. He got over it. Oh, mercy.
So then we can kind of move fast forward back now to when you had finished off your postdoctoral tour in France.
Yeah.
So you've had a little bit of European experience there, going to both Germany and France. So that was during your career. That was kind of probably interesting and fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, in that tour around with my cousin, I remembered never having had a bad meal in France. So I took the opportunity to go back to France at my first opportunity, which happened to be this postdoctoral experience.
Uh-huh. So
at Strasbourg.
He took you around not just Germany, but other places in Europe besides Germany. That's good.
Yeah.
Nice.
But we visited, among other things, Neuschwanstein,
uh-huh.
This wonderful
Mid-King
castle. Yeah. Oh yeah, we went to Italy. We went to Pompeii.
Wow.
Naples, Rome.
That was fun. Good experience.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, it was wonderful.
So you are wrapping up your postdoctoral stint. You got to find some place to work.
Yeah.
You're pretty much committed to academia by now. You're not interested in going into industrial facilities.
I think that's right. I had my sights set on some academic job if I could find one. And as it turned out, my good friend James McCloskey had apparently interacted with, perhaps on a site visit, some faculty at Vanderbilt University in pharmacology, and he knew that they were starting a division of clinical pharmacology where they were going to use a mass spectrometer to help with a methodology, and they were looking for a person that might help them set that kind of analytical facility up. And so I applied for that, and went back to the United States and went to Vanderbilt, gave a seminar, and ended up being hired upon return from Europe, which was the start of my academic career. Suddenly, I was assistant professor of pharmacology.
Yeah, I was wondering about how you got into the pharmacology business.
And I, at that point, I didn't know the difference between pharmacology and pharmacy. So I sat in on the course, the main course of pharmacology, the first year, and got myself oriented.
So what is the difference between...
So pharmacy is the formulation of drugs for ingestion. Pharmacology is a study of the mechanism of action of the drug.
So it's like pharmacy research, you'd say.
Well, and so in clinical pharmacology in particular was directed toward drug interactions. But of course, all that required a knowledge of the mechanism of action of the drugs of interest. Uh-huh. And usually it was, the interactions could be explained by the commonalities of the mechanism of action. But I was working with John Oates, who was the division chief of clinical pharmacology at Vanderbilt. He was starting up a program where he wanted to get into the prostaglandin field. And so I helped set up methodology that would be able to detect and quantitate prostaglandins, endogenous prostaglandins, using stable isotope labeled analogs as internal standards, a methodology not totally unique to what we were doing there at Vanderbilt, because investigators at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm were already doing that kind of approach, but they needed to have that kind of methodology set up at Vanderbilt to support the clinical pharmacology studies of involving, with a putative involvement of prostaglandins.
Uh-huh. So why the interest in prostaglandins?
Well, it was a new and coming field, new and coming. It was about this time that John Vane from Great Britain had discovered the mechanism of action of aspirin, namely that it is an inhibitor of cyclooxygenase, the main enzyme in the pathway, synthetic, biosynthetic pathway of prostaglandins from the precursor of arachidonic acid.
Boy.
And so there were many ancillary therapies ongoing at Vanderbilt that required knowledge of whether the cyclooxygenase pathway was extant. And so the analytical methodology based on mass spectrometry for prostaglandins and thromboxanes was of paramount importance to the clinical pharmacology group at Vanderbilt.
Thromboxanes?
Yes.
That's another class of...
That's an alternate pathway to prostaglandins.
Okay.
Also coming out of, all of these are in the so-called arachidonic acid cascade. Prostaglandins and thromboxanes are downstream metabolites of arachidonic acid.
Oh boy. So you're really into the kind of biochemistry. Biology, biochemistry, as well as when you get into this pharmacology business.
Yeah. Well, pharmacology is a fascinating field. You know, if I had it to do over, I might well go into pharmacology. Pharmacology is a wonderful mixture of biochemistry, physiology, analytical chemistry, anatomy. It's very interesting. Very interesting.
Hmm. Now, like a catch-all area.
Boy.
But it's basically your skill set in mass spectrometry that...
That made me attracted. Oh, absolutely.
What kind of equipment did they have?
So they had an LKB.
Oh, wow.
LKB 9000 had shown up on the loading dock at Vanderbilt Medical School, and they didn't know what to do with it. So they were delighted that I showed up.
Well, somebody bought the blinking thing. Who bought it?
I opened the box, took out the LKB and set it up. Got it running. Today, the platform on which the LKB was mounted for shipment from Stockholm resides in my workshop in the barn as a work table. So the LKB 9000 is a magnetic sector mass spectrometer, single stage, single focusing.
Oh, okay. Was getting a functional problem?
No.
Pretty straightforward. Biggest problem is you had a difference in power requirements, right? Or did they already include a transformer for that? Or
Someone took care of that. It ran on 220.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, most everything in Europe is 220.
Yeah.
And so 220 was... there was probably an issue with the phase, but I didn't have to figure that out.
Yeah.
There were electrical people that got that squared away.
Yeah.
Under the auspices of LKB, installation engineers.
So they did send an engineer to have installed.
No, there were no.
No.
They did not. There was LKB had. Centers of technical support in the States, I think on the East Coast, probably in the Washington D.C. area, as I recall, Maryland.
So they gave you like phone support, or gave the Vanderbilt the phone support. How did what you do?
Well, just to get it installed.
Yeah.
And then I took over.
Yeah.
As far as getting it running and showing its relevance and its relevance for prostaglandins and establishing detection limits, linearity of calibration curves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Had the jet separator on it?
Yeah, it had the stainless steel jet separator, which is a diffusion oriented separator, as opposed to the F fusion based separator at molecular flow that I developed at MIT.
Yeah. Okay.
So it worked just fine. I didn't have a problem with that. This was designed by Ragnar Rihagi at the Karolinska.
Yeah. And that was, I think, a pretty popular instrument with the medical community because they had street cred, LKB had street cred with the people in the medical facilities, so it made sense to buy an instrument like a mass spec from somebody who, you know, you had some respect.
I see.
In other areas. I mean, that's a pretty popular piece of equipment in certain areas.
I see.
That was the impression that I got from it. I do know that it's hard. I know at one time McDonnell Douglas was trying to market some biomedical equipment into the clinical laboratories, and it was a beautiful thing. You could see logically how it worked. You could see that it would work, it did work, it was functional, it was fast, efficient, but it's just that resistance to buy a piece of equipment from an outfit that
Didn't have a track record.
Doesn't have a track record in their business. And consequently, I think they finally broke in with it. It just took forever and ever.
What was it?
It was...
A mass spectrometer?
No. This was they developed a little thing for space where they could try and where they would be able to diagnose if an astronaut came down with a certain kind of, you know, bacterial infection or cold or what have you.
Oh.
And it was a little plate with a bunch of wells in it, and each one had a culture that would be a good culture for a certain bug.
I see.
Okay,
so they would take saliva or swab
or blood or urine or whatever.
I see.
And there was a little, you know, thing to pull a sample, liquid sample down through a bunch of channels and all these.
Oh, I need, yeah.
And then they had a card reader which would look and see, you know, I mean, basically
which one
where they'd be opaque if one of these
reactions
lit up or was, you know, was friendly to that particular.
Yeah, I see.
Bacterium, and then, you know, okay, so right there, in a very short period of time, you have a good idea as to whether this guy had, you know, which bacterial infection he had, if he had any at all.
I see.
And so, you know, they packaged this thing and made it look as, you know, sex and everything else, and they're just like, you know, taking and ramming your head into a brick wall to try and get the clinical lab people to even, you know, buy a test kit. You know, just this is the way we do it, and don't bother me with your
new improved
ideas.
Well, okay, I see.
But I mean, that's not atypical. It's
well, sure.
I mean, the engineers are the worst about that. We had the fellow in our research lab developed what they call a pressure sensitive paint. And they use that to find out what the different characteristics of an aerodynamic shape would be in a wind tunnel. Now, the way that's normally done is you put little, what they call pitot tubes, all through your surface in as many places as you think you need to
measure it. Yeah.
Measure it, and then you run these all these basically stainless steel capillaries, thin wall tubes out to a point where you can measure all their pressures.
I see.
They get plugged up one thing or another. Mm-hmm. The deal with pressure sensitive paint is you paint your object, put it in a wind tunnel, and you shine a light on it a certain wavelength, and it luminesces back in a different wavelength as a function of the amount of oxygen that is interacting with the paint.
which is a function
of distribution of the pressure points all over the object.
Wow.
And it's, you know, I mean, so
that's pretty cute.
It is.
That's pretty cute.
And eventually they bought it, but it took forever because these guys, you know, oh, we can't do this. This is the way we do it. And it
took
years and years and years. And finally now they're using it. And it saved these guys $1 zillion. And besides, the thing about the pressure system paint is it shows you everything. So if you're instrumenting an airfoil with pitot tubes, you may not put one in your disturbing, but you may not put one where there's some action that you need to know about. Because
you didn't know a priori.
Right. You're kind of predetermining the results of the experiment. But with the paint, they found out all kinds of things about the airfoil that they would have never known with the old technology. But they finally caught on. But this is an aside. We don't need to talk about Boeing. But anyway, there is a certain resistance in various areas to when someone from the outside comes in and says, you know, look at this, this is the greatest thing since Frederick and Little Kills.
Did you see Gravity?
No, I have not seen Gravity.
Okay.
Did you?
Yeah.
Is it worth seeing?
Yeah.
Okay.
But there are many technical oversights.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to discuss those with you.
Well.
But you can't do it. So I'm not going to taint you.
Okay.
You look at it, and we'll talk.
Okay. So you pretty much established your reputation at Vanderbilt. I mean, people came to respect what you were doing there.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, I mean, you got the mass spec working, and you were using it in a way that they were interested in.
Yeah. So I was the mass spec guy.
No. Did you have any students there, grad students?
I had one. And I wanted to, but you know, I was in pharmacology.
So you were not in a traditional chemistry setting?
Absolutely not. I was in a traditional pharmacology setting.
Oh, wow, okay.
And the graduate students wanted to work with someone who was doing blood and guts experiments. You know, like you walk down the hall in a pharmacology department, and every other lab you see a dog laying there, disemboweled, and catheters and all kinds of things through its heart and through its lungs and through its liver, and doing metabolic studies and you know, all kinds of blood and guts type stuff like that. And I wasn't doing anything like that.
No, no, no.
And so my students, so to speak, were postdocs who were coming to learn clinical pharmacology, and they would work with me to learn methodology that would be important to their current project and to their future career elsewhere in clinical pharmacology. And so they, you know, I'd set them up with selected ion monitoring for their particular molecule, and wasn't always prostaglandins. It could be other drugs, because there was a lot of hypertensive studies going on in clinical pharmacology. I mean, these people had clinical appointments. Most of my colleagues, MDs of my age, were the theme was heavily into hypertension.
Oh, okay.
Either usually figuring out protocols for monitoring or figuring out drug interaction problems.
So when you're using the term clinical, it has I get the sense that it has a very specific meaning.
Well, what that means is that your experimental animals are human beings.
Oh. I see.
That's the key issue. That's what distinguishes pharmacology per se and clinical pharmacology. is that the experiments are done on humans with consent. But they are very heavily, very, very super heavily monitored.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a good, if you want to get close to medical attention, be a patient.
Okay.
And in a hypertensive test, man, you get very careful scrutiny.
They keep a close eye on
you. Oh, man. Yeah.
Now, did you actually, were you in a position to teach any classes?
I taught, well, with the pharmacology course at Vanderbilt was team taught. There'd be, well, we'd all give two or three lectures. So there was very little teaching. And so in my case, I was given the topics that nobody else wanted to lecture on.
Because you were the outsider.
I was the new boy. I lectured on antihistamines. I lectured on antimalarials. And I lectured on prostaglandins. Because there was no expert on prostaglandins. So I had to learn about that, which was not too tough. There wasn't much known about it.
So basically this was explaining the action of these various compounds.
No. Now what?
Your lectures on the antihistamines and antimalarials and prostaglandins.
Those are just topics that I had to research and come up with a lecture.
Okay.
You know, and antimalarials, there was a presumption of expertise or knowledge of parasitology, of which I had zero. And so I spent a hell of a lot of time just trying to get myself up to speed with where the medical students were, because this was given. So the pharmacology course was the course offered by the pharmacology faculty to the medical school class. So we would go in as teams, and you know, we're going to have the next few lectures are going to be on pharmacology, and here are the topics, and here are the guys who are going to give the lectures, and so I was, you know, so we had, there was, the teaching load was very light in pharmacology. People had clinical responsibilities elsewhere, except for me. And so I was on the list of instructors going in front of 110 medical students.
Yeah, I was asking about how big the
place is. You know, it's one of the top medical schools in the country. And here I am giving lectures to them. Are you kidding? As a pharmacologist, are you kidding me? Oh, shit. Oh, mercy.
Well, apparently you succeeded.
Well, you know, I got to brag a little bit. I think it might have been after my lecture on antihistamines that the class stood up and applauded.
Oh, my.
And I had seen that with none of the other faculty. So, you know, I was scared into really researching, you know, and studying like crazy to give these lectures. Because, you know, this is all new material to me. So it was just that I'd given apparently a very systematic lecture that they could tune into.
Well, apparently we're communicating the material, which is what they...
Yeah, but you know, anyway. So that was quite rewarding.
Now, did you do this like for the whole time you were at Vanderbilt, this team teaching this stuff? Or
yeah.
So this was your part of your career there?
Yeah. Yeah, I was on the faculty. I was a faculty member of pharmacology, which was a joke. But, you know, when I would zoom in on an area, I would do best I could. And I think my knack for my book's success is that I always, all my writing was done in the context of remembering how I encountered those topics.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there were books when I was a graduate student, early on, with the words on the front cover, Introduction to Mass Spectrometry. And I would read those books, and I couldn't understand what the hell was going on. So when I wrote my book, I had Introduction to Mass Spectrometry on the title. But I wrote it based on how I remember encountering the topic. And had that kind of
discovery.
Empathy, so to speak, for for the reader. And I think that's what made my book popular enough to ask for another edition. And Sparkman is pretty good at that. It's pretty, you know, I kept hammering that we need to do didactic examples. And he was always hammering me for, what do you mean didactic? Well, what I liked about CSI, when Gil was the main guy, you know, I thought those shows were didactic. That is, when they wanted to examine the slug dug out of this Vic, the show would take you to the microscope, and it would show you what the guy was looking at.
Yeah.
And they would describe, oh, well, this is because of this line here, that shows the mark that the barrel made to this and that and so forth. And it would explain the technology in the context of solving the problem. Mm-hmm. And that's what I kept hammering David. David, that's what we have to do. That's what didactic means. And we had a lot of, I remember too, it was my boss, John Oates, when I started to write the book. He was a little bit reluctant to have me do it because he knew what I was getting into, and I didn't. But he said, you know, Jack, he said, what? And he was talking from the standpoint of his physician students. You know, they don't need to know the alignment of the slits, and they want to know what the impact is on, what do you need, what kind of sample do you need, what do the data sort of look like, and he said, why don't you come up with half a dozen simple examples where you show what certain things mean. And so I came up with this nice, I still love it, this example of the mass spectrum of acetone, showing the molecular ion, how it fragments in a decomposition manner based on electron movement, odd electron movement, that explains cleavage, homolytic cleavage, and eventually heterolytic cleavage. And the difference between the mass spectrum. So I chose the example of acetone and acetaldehyde. Those are isomers. They have the same molecular weight.
Uh-huh.
So if you were only to do the mass, you wouldn't know which one you had. But if you let it fragment, they fragment differently, vastly differently, to give a characteristic and interpretable mass spectrum. And that didactic example was in my first edition, and it's in our fourth edition.
So you decided to do this book project while you're at Vanderbilt?
Yeah, well, what happened was that before I left Europe, I went up at the request of Vanderbilt, because I had already gotten the offer, Vanderbilt. And they said, go up and visit Bo Humstead at the Karolinska.
Who?
Bo Humstead.
Bo.
Yeah, and that's B-O, as opposed to B-O-O. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And he was a fairly well-known, internationally known, actually, pharmacologist, psychopharmacologist, and a publisher called Raven Press had contacted Bo and asked him to write a book on mass spectrometry. And Bo says, shit, I don't have time for that. Mm-hmm. And I had just visited his lab, and I guess he took a liking to me. And so he told Raven Press to contact me at Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. And so I was gullible enough to, you know, it was publish or perish. Mm-hmm. Here's an opportunity to write a book, for Christ's sake. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. Oh my gosh. What a nightmare. How many books have you written?
Well, the only thing I've ever gotten involved in was editing Measuring Mass, so I never wrote a book. I did some editing.
Yeah, it's just an unbelievable exercise in organization and tough work research wise. I gotta go take a leap.
Okay, we'll take a break here.
Huh?
I'll put it on a.
I better. Oh.
Okay.
It's recording. So, yeah, Bo Humstead.
Bo Humstead.
Got you.
Yeah.
Why did you go to you went to the Karolinska Institute before you left France?
Before I left Europe.
Before you left Europe for Vanderbilt.
Yeah, I just want to. The Vanderbilt people, faculty, the chairman, and the new director of the clinical pharmacology division at Vanderbilt knew that Bo Humstead was at the Karolinska, and that he had an LKB, and that it wouldn't hurt anything if I went up there and just visited with him, I did. And furthermore, I wanted to go to Copenhagen,
sure,
and have some beer and so forth. And it was a nice little visit. And as it turned out, as a result of that, Bo got me this recommendation, which has got me into the book writing business.
Oh, boy. Which you're ever thankful, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was such a nightmare. You know, just keeping track of the figures. Because in those days, that was when we still having figure was a matter of a drawing that was done with block print somehow by a draftsman. And then they'd take a photograph of the darn thing. Oh my gosh. And so I was coming up with all these figures, and you know, figure 17 might be 3 by 4 feet in dimension, and figure 27 might be the size of a 3 by 5 card, and just keeping track of where those were, you know, and then writing about them, and then having a photograph taken, which would then be submitted with the manuscript, was a real headache. And then there was, of course, the task of writing something. You know, the agony of the first draft. Oh, the agony. And I was just overwhelmed trying to keep track of all that.
Well, at least you didn't have that many classes to teach.
Yeah, my teaching load was not an issue. That was right. It was just the book. But it was just the management of my own activities relating to the book.
Uh-huh.
Was a massive project. And I had, I would write it out longhand on paper and give it to a secretary who would give me a draft. Mm-hmm. And then I'd have to correct the draft, and of course then she'd make typos in the second draft. And there was no word processing, that is to say, you couldn't go back and correct a line.
Yeah.
But I remember when the IBM came out with a sort of a word processor, something that would at least allow you to repeat a paragraph somewhere, mm-hmm. that you could actually correct, so that when it printed out, it would the hard copy would show the edits.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big deal.
Well, yeah.
Oh, mercy. So in contrast with that, our fourth edition, I mean, I typed virtually every word on the word on my laptop.
Yeah.
And did my own editing.
That was in 2000.
I started that in 2002.
Okay.
And we finished in 2007.
Okay.
And then David Sparkman and I would fight and argue over the first draft, which was, of course, of prime importance, finally had a foothold.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd fight and scream over various presentations, various descriptions, but we're still good friends. But all those arguments, I'm sure, made it a better book.
Well,
because it was really the reader was the beneficiary, mm-hmm. as it should be.
I mean, you have two knowledgeable people debating. The issue is how best to present a topic.
And, that's right.
If you're working with someone who's knowledgeable, then that's okay. But you sometimes get stuck with someone who's not knowledgeable. That's a little bit different project. So you started the first book. Was it like shortly after you got to Vanderbilt?
No. No, it was well into it.
You waited a while.
Yeah, well, this all happened. You know, I didn't initiate anything. Raven Press contacted me, mm-hmm. and I gather I mean, I could figure it out time-wise, but it was 5 or 6 months after I got to Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm. And so you acquiesced, and you say Oates was a little bit, he was trying to save you from yourself here?
Well, I think he knew that it was going to take a lot of time, and that was going to take away from my duties as a mass spec expert serving his research program.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think he also realized that it was going to be a feather in the cap of not only me, but of his faculty.
Uh-huh.
And his research, and we had a center grant from NIH, a center for clinical pharmacology.
Okay.
And there were many, many, many different facets, of which analytical chemistry was an important one, and mass spectrometry was an important subfacet of that. So he saw it as somewhat of a dilution of my efforts in his interest area, maybe, but he also saw it as an asset for renewal of the grant that supported the whole thing, showing that on a national, international level, we had expertise in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
So I did it. Oh, what a job. Oh, I mean, I finally got down to the point where our children were young, like 4 or 5 years old, and they were at this stage waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
And so, or sometimes they would get up even before that. So the kids may be younger than I said. They may have been 2 or 3. And so they were not so much night owls, but they got up early.
Mm.
Or we got them up early somehow, anyway. And so what I would do would be I would get up with the kids, and I would go down to the basement where I had an old door set up on sawhorses to serve as a huge desk to keep track of all these aspects that I was working on. Where was figure 37? Where is reference 16? And who's the third author on reference 12? And all that, which is so easy to figure out these days with computers, but at that time I was using a pad of paper and a pencil and a ballpoint in writing longhand and just keeping track of this stuff by making notes to myself. And so it was exhausting. And it seemed hopeless. I couldn't see the end. Oh my gosh. I was in a quicksand. Oh, it was always frightening. Oh.
So how well was it accepted when it got published?
It was accepted. I mean, my colleagues even said that it was remarkable, and I couldn't believe they were saying this. And it was well accepted.
Well, worth it.
I guess. I mean, what makes it worth it is when someone comes and tells you that it helped them.
Uh-huh.
And this really hit home to me one time when I went to the ASMS meeting. And at the ASMS meeting, when you register you go to the desk, the registration desk, and that's often manned mm-hmm. by a graduate student from some laboratory other than your own, and because this is a way to help support graduate student expense to attend the meeting. There's the ASMS makes this available. Mm-hmm. So I would go. I went to the registration desk, and the young man says, "What's your name?" And I said, "Watson, Jack Throck Watson." And he says, "Oh, I read your book. It helped me so much." I mean, this is an unsolicited testimonial that means the world. Mm-hmm. This makes suddenly all this agony of writing the damn thing worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And my own students, of course, and the students that I had at Michigan State in the chemistry department who were taking mass spectrometry from a collage of different mass spectrometry books, the word got around that the one to read first was mine. Mm-hmm. And they told me so. And that meant a lot to me. That meant an awful lot to me.
Yeah.
That's you know, the few $1,000 I've made from royalties is just utterly ridiculous what that amounts to in terms of pay per hour.
Yeah.
It's just, I stopped making the calculation because it's so so pathetic and depressing.
So you were throughout their assistant professor, so you were granted tenure in 73, I guess.
Oh, at Vanderbilt, yeah.
At Vanderbilt?
Yeah, I was made associate professor with tenure.
Yeah. So that was a nice step forward.
Yeah, and then I got the then Chuck Sweeney called me up one day and said he wanted me. He was stepping down from director of the mass spec facility at Michigan State and wanted me to interview for the position. I said, "Chuck, you're too big a statue for me to come up there and do that." Mm-hmm. He says, "I'm done." Well, good old Chuck. I'd known him for years.
So he actually invited you to apply for the position.
Yeah, he was lockstep with me every step of the way, making sure that I. Got in the door.
So this was towards the end of his career?
Yeah, well, so the deal was that there was a need for a new chairman of biochemistry.
Okay.
And he wanted that. So he was stepping down from... He was wanting to unload the mass spec facility responsibility,
uh-huh.
which was that of being the principal investigator
right.
of a NIH research resource. Oh, I don't have to tell you.
Yeah.
Jeez. I'm sorry. Oh, shit.
I know.
Research resource.
Yeah.
Oh, and he was tired of all the administrative bullshit that goes along with that. And Klaus had warned me about that. Klaus hated all the administrative bullshit. But you know, you got to take some bullshit to get the jewels.
Mm-hmm. So those grants usually run like 5 years with reports, right? Every year.
Yeah.
And
oh my, yes.
And so how long had the grant been there.
It was...
When you came, he was, I mean, usually there, you know...
Yeah, he initiated it. And I think it was established in 1968.
Oh, okay. That long.
I think. I you know, I've got the data somewhere. But is that important?
No, it's just that the idea that it was a fairly well established operation.
Oh, absolutely.
At the time that he had invited you to come on board. And
that's right.
He wanted to keep that facility there.
That's right, he did.
Because, you know, it had a certain amount of panache to it to have that recognition from the school. And,
And so he had been through two renewals, I think.
Okay. So that would have been like the late, late 60s. By the time he got there, 1980, early 70s.
I think Chuck had it. Yeah, they were, going in. I think that's roughly right. Do you want? Are you putting those kind of dates in there?
Well, it's just an approximate date is fine. It's just a good idea. The whole idea that it was an ongoing concern.
That's right.
Was functioning.
So
you want someone to carry it on to continue it. I had something I was going to ask you. Okay. Did you know if he asked any other people to apply for the position, or did he pretty much handpick you out ahead of time and guide you?
I think it was that, but I do know that Catherine Fenzelau was a candidate.
Ah, okay.
And I hear from John Allison that she really wanted it.
Uh-huh.
And I think she was really pissed that I got it.
Yeah, well.
And I feel that she torpedoed me.
Uh-huh.
One of my last site visits of the facility.
Oh.
I think she had some sugar. I think, and Allison knew that. Allison. You know, Allison grew up in Fenzelau's shadow, so to speak.
Oh, really?
Out there with Burnaby.
Uh-huh.
You know, Allison, you know who John Allison is?
The name is familiar, but
we don't want to write this down anywhere. We don't want this in the book. This is just off the record.
All right. Well, here, let me turn off the record recorder, and we can talk off the record. Hang on just a second.
Oh, okay.
If I push this button, we'll pause.
Yeah. No.
So we were wrapping up our discussion on your being selected by
Charles.
Chuck Seward to manage the NIH research resource in mass spectrometry at the Michigan State University, which he had initiated, and he wanted to see continued while he moved on to bigger and better things. So you landed there in about 1980, I think it was. And
that's about right.
Now you're in a more of a natural setting, you might say.
So part of my agreement to come to Michigan State was that I get an appointment in chemistry.
You didn't want this pharmacology stuff.
Being at Vanderbilt in the medical school was like being in the Air Force and not being a pilot. It was the way I felt about it. I was just not one of the boys. And I tried to get an appointment in chemistry. I went over there.
At Vanderbilt?
At Vanderbilt.
Uh-huh.
And basically the answer was that, I was a nice guy and everything, but they didn't say it exactly, but in essence, I was going to be a threat
to depleting their pool of graduate students. I probably would have pulled several.
So even though you tried to, you approached the chemistry department at Vanderbilt, they were...
They did not entertain them. I think it came up at a faculty meeting, and they said, well, we have trouble enough getting enough grad students for ourselves.
Without having you come here.
Yeah, I that's got to be what happened. I think. So when Caprioli went there, he made it a condition that he get an appointment in chemistry.
You know when he showed up?
What?
I mean, did you know when Caprioli showed up at Vanderbilt? Or, I mean, did he kind of... did he go into pharmacology when he went there, do you know? Or, I mean, did, like, did he take over your job, so to speak? Or?
Yeah, and more. I mean, he established his imaging facility there, and he immediately assumed professorship of chemistry. And whether he is also professor of pharmacology, I don't know. Or he may also be professor of biochemistry. He probably made those demands, and they probably were honored. I think he's fitted. He's happy there. He's got some really interesting projects going with the surgical staff. Yeah, it's neat stuff. My former technicians are working for him. They're happy with him. He's happy. It's a wonderful school.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice place to live.
No, so then, but that was a condition that you made going to Michigan State, is that you wanted to be a member of the chemistry faculty.
Correct.
So was that an issue? I mean, they wouldn't have just brought you in to head the research or so, would they, or did they want you? Or?
As it turns out, the research resource, for political reasons, was housed in the biochemistry building.
Okay.
And because that was part of the College of Human Medicine.
Yeah.
And Sweeley had been the a research director or something for the College of Human Medicine. So there was a lot of politics, a lot of overhead distribution that was going to be controlled by this and that, and so is it. I don't think I'm answering your question.
Well, would you have been appointed to a faculty appointment in biochemistry then?
Oh, I was.
Okay, but you also that's
my primary. And my secondary appointment is in chemistry.
Okay.
And so, I think they would have pursued it. Chemistry didn't know anything about me.
Mm-hmm.
John Allison did.
Where was he on the faculty then? At the time?
Yeah, yeah.
He was in the chemistry department.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, these resources have a way of kind of falling in strange places. When Mike went to Washington U, most of the research was in med school, and he wanted it in the chemistry department, or part of it anyway, so it kind of got not exactly split, but it had two sites, so to speak, one in chemistry and one in med school. But that's another story.
Yeah.
Now you're able to take graduate students, I guess, in this environment.
Me?
Yeah, when you moved to Michigan State.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
I had a lot of graduate students.
But I mean, not like at Vanderbilt, that really.
Yeah,
I mean, I was in the.
I had my only appointment was in pharmacology, and none of the pharmacology graduate students wanted to work for me.
Yeah,
they wanted blood and guts.
Yeah, yeah. But that all changed when you get to the state.
And I did have one graduate student at Vanderbilt, and he was in engineering, computer engineering, I think. And
I think your microphone is getting filled here. Oh, it just keeps. We need to fix it.
Well, do what you need to do.
Yeah, just so it doesn't slide away here. I'm going to have to move your. And put it over here. Oh, come on. No. Okay. Now we're connected better.
Yeah, so now being here, it was in the biochemistry, but I had an official appointment also in chemistry. And so when the grad students come in to Michigan State, they are subjected to a 2 or 3 hours of many, many, many presentations by the faculty,
oh boy,
giving a hint of what we're doing, and followed up by individual interviews with the faculty members. So what's the question?
Well, now you're able to take graduate students aggressively, so to speak.
Yeah.
Before you, there was.
I was crippled. I was just the pathway wasn't there.
Yeah.
Uh huh. Oh yeah.
So this was a major, obviously, was a major step up in your career.
Oh, absolutely. This was a quantum step.
And. Were most of these people coming to with an interest in mass spectrometry?
Yeah.
So they got this. Gave a spiel to entering graduate students, and they got the messages of whether or not that was something that they wanted to get involved in.
Yeah. Well, I gave them the point that I was biomedically oriented, and it was working. It was mass spectrometry working with biomolecules.
Okay.
And that sounded attractive to a lot of them. Plus, it was well known that I had a lot of money. Because I took training as a very serious issue in my RR budget.
Uh-huh.
I really pumped it in there. And I think it was Bob Murphy that expressed some real displeasure.
Oh, really?
that I was
pushing the training too hard.
Yeah, that I was asking for too much money.
Ah.
Well, shit. So he was jealous. You know, I think there's a lot of that going on.
Well, those guys are all competing for a while.
That's right.
Other.
Yeah. But he was downright offended that my budget was bigger than his.
Because of the training that you were...
Apparently. Now he said, Jack, when you ask for that much money, you're telling me that you're better than I am.
Uh-huh.
Jeez. So I shut up. Well... You know, jeez, that's pretty tough.
Yeah, but you try and do what you think is best for your.
Yeah, I mean they can always not fund it, for crying out loud. Yeah. They can cut it back.
Yeah, I mean when they decide to fund it, then they tell Murphy that you're better than he is. When they decide to fund it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, But Bob and I were friends and still are, long before the site visit battles. Oh, man.
So basically, you managed the resource all the way up through 1999.
Oh, I suppose.
That's what it says here. And then, is it still at Michigan State?
No.
Okay.
No, we lost. Yeah, I don't remember what year it was, but it might have been 99.
Well, that would have worked out because it would have been like 20 years from 1980 to 2000. So, you know, four renewals.
You know, Brian Chite and I used to get together and talk about how many more renewals are we going to put up with. Oh man, what a these site visits are such a exhausting.
I wonder myself how many renewals Gross is going to put up with. I think he's going for another one now. You know, as we speak, and it just seems to me like it's such a drag.
Oh my gosh, it's well, haven't you been through one?
Oh yeah, I've been to two of them. It's Gross.
Oh well.
You know, I mean,
well, it's an immense undertaking.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, I mean, I got the, you know, that was my job, was to deal with all the paper garbage.
Really?
Yeah, that was I'm just a, you know, glorified paper pusher for Gross. When you get right down to it, I mean, I did all the stuff in the lab and, you know, taught the kids how to use instruments, but that was why he hired me, really, is to deal with the paperwork and the resource.
Yeah, what does that mean? Writing the annual report?
Yeah, you got to manage the annual report, and then when it came time around, of course, I mean, then he stepped up to the bat when it came time for renewal, you know, and put in more effort, but basically the annual report was, you know.
Yeah, I let Doug Gage do that.
Yeah, well, he let me do that.
Doug Gage was a good service manager. Uh-huh. Doug Gage was a good scientist and a nice guy. But he do you know Doug Gage?
No, I don't.
He's too nice a guy, actually. He couldn't kick ass and take names like Sparkman could. So, you know, there was disarray in the staff. Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought you were going to do that. No, I thought you were going to do that. Well, Sparkman would say, well, get your ass over there and get that done. or Musselman would do that. Uh-huh. Musselman was a great manager. And Musselman's also a good scientist, actually.
Mm-hmm. He's a crazy guy, too.
I never, Sparkman pushed me to ask him to be my manager. And I, once I met Musselman, I said, oh, you got to be kidding. He was so obnoxious. But I came to really like him, and he was very good as a manager. Very good. And he, you know, I can remember him saying, after one of our site visits, you know, after it's over, it's such a huge letdown.
Yeah.
And Musselman stood up after that. We were sitting around saying, well, we don't have to fire all that shit anymore. Musselman said, the time to prepare for the next renewal is now.
Oh, wow.
And he's right, of course.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, nobody had the strength or the...
They were burned out.
We were all so burned out. Oh, those site visits are such a bitch. Especially have someone like Finzel come in and sabotage things. Mm. Yeah, I can't prove that, so...
Well, I see here, after you had been at Michigan State for a while, you had this sabbatical leave to Paris, a school in the École Normale Supérieure, Lab de Chimie Paris, with Christian Rolando. That sounded like fun. When was that? I mean, what did you do there?
Well, you know Christian Rolando?
I do not.
Christian Rolando is a remarkable guy. He's a fantastic combination of organic synthesis chemist, computer expert, both hardware and software.
Oh boy. So how did you
At ease and enjoys tearing equipment apart and rebuilding it. Or
modifying it.
Yes. And it's just, and he's it's just, and he's a nice, he's a fun guy, and he has wild ass and interesting ideas. He's just really great. But when it came time for me to go on sabbatical, I asked the near mag people with whom Sparkman was working, where I could, I wanted to go to Paris. Uh-huh. I wanted to do a sabbatical in France. And I said, who would be good to work for? And they said, Christian Rolando. Well, it turned out they were right. Christian Rolando was just bringing to operation a Penta quadrupole.
Five quadrupoles.
What this means is that you can manufacture by ion molecule collisions reagent ions to send into a reaction chamber to undergo reactions and use the fifth quadrupole to analyze the products thereof. Pretty clever, huh?
Now, these quadrupoles are not aligned in a linear
fashion. Yes.
They are.
Yeah.
One after the other.
Yeah, it's sort of like a triple quad, except it's a pentaquad.
Okay.
And he built it.
Okay.
He's a little bit crazy in that he never, he, like I, never throws anything away. But in his case, it's the radio from the Rebear quadrupole back in 1950.
Uh-huh.
But you know, there'll be a use for it. There'll be a flange from this diffusion pump, big work on this thing here because it's got a big, and he would do hydrogen discharges to make a high concentration of hydrogen atoms, which of course are very reactive.
Yeah.
But he had this wild discharge.
Sort of
violet. And he'd have that be right on the source. he had no fear. Anyway, that's how I came about that I went to Ecole Normale Supérieure, which is the Harvard of France.
Uh-huh. And so, used this pentaquadrupole to.
We did some wild ass experiments. Some that my grad students had started with Inky.
Uh-huh.
And did it better with Christian Rolando because we could control the reagents.
Ah, okay.
Well, anyway. But don't.
Fun year.
It was great fun. Plus, I got to eat in a French restaurant every night.
Oh, wow. 1988, I guess the French attitude towards Americans had mellowed some, or was it still pretty appreciative? Or?
I think it was. I had any problem. I remember. I don't know which trip it was, but when I was in southern France one time, somehow it was got in a conversation where I could sort of understand what they were saying, but some of these old Frenchmen had heard that I was an American and everything, and they were saying thank you to me for 1944. I said, don't thank me. Thank my cousins. Mm-hmm. It was my cousins that ran across Omaha Beach. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that, you know, they went in on the 17th run. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't hell as it was in Saving Private Ryan, which you probably saw. I mean, can you imagine the horror of that? I can't. But my cousins didn't have to tolerate that. They probably got some flack. But when they got to the top of the ridge, they had to go through the hedgerows where the Germans were entrenched. And they slept in the mud for months. One of my cousins was one of the first guys across the Rhine in the Battle of the Bulge. And his platoon was decimated as they crossed the Rhine. The Germans let him get about 80% of the way across, and they opened up on him. It took all night, he said, for some of his guys to die.
Yeah, tough time.
Yeah, he lost his mind, actually. He never recovered. Post-traumatic stress syndrome. Uh-huh. Yeah, he was a casualty, mentally.
So what do you think were your most important developments for science when you were at Michigan State?
My graduate students.
Okay.
But you know, I came up, we came up with, of course, all these students that I had from chemistry, I had to come up with an analytical project. A project that would meet the demands of the analytical chemistry department, analytical chemistry group, and also satisfy the needs for these students to get a flavor of biochemistry. Mm-hmm. So one of my postdocs pointed out to me, all of a sudden, in the beginning of the Fab days, mm-hmm. we had a... Oh, well, I just had a new postdoc come in who had been studying X-ray crystallography of proteins at Purdue, and he wanted to get some experience in mass spectrometry. So he turned out to be the resident expert in proteins. Uh-huh. Not by mass spectrometry, none of us knew what the hell to do. It was John Stultz who began to get us into the peptide sequencing business in a serious manner. Mm-hmm. But it turned out this guy from Purdue, whose name is Gene Zaluzek.
Is that G-N-E or?
Yeah. Eugene.
Okay.
Z-A-L
U Z E C. Zeluzek. You can see him in my bibliography somewhere. He turned out to have a lot of experience with sulfur. Sulfur chemistry. And at the fab time, somehow, it might have been Doug Gage, who was representing the interests of some of our service clients, were interested in cysteine, the amino acid that forms double bonds, disulfide bonds, I'm sorry. Yeah. And it became as simple as, are there any cysteines in my peptide? And if so, how many? What? Well, and of course, that was at the time when we didn't have very good accuracy on our fab. And so there was a lot of error in the determination of the M over Z value of the protonated molecule. And so our idea was to make a derivative of the cysteine by adding something to it that would greatly magnify its mass. Among other things, you could add a mercury atom. Or you could add some other chemical that would make a covalent bond with a cysteine, and you knew what you were doing chemistry-wise, and so you knew what the mass of the additive was, and that then told you, it made it easier to, you got a higher mass, and exaggerated at the site of cysteine. So we were sort of getting in the business. But then my postdoc, Eugene, pointed out to me one day some work that had been reported by chemists at UCLA. And I should remember the names of those guys, but I never do. But what those guys did was make a thiocyano group added to the cysteine. Well, that was no big deal, really. But what was interesting was that when they took this thiocyano derivative of the cysteine peptide, they put it in a solution with a nucleophile, like ammonia, it caused a rearrangement of that moiety, resulting in cleavage of the peptide bond, cleavage of the peptide chain on the amino terminal side of the cysteine. So that was just another chemical tool we used. But I finally realized that, you know, it wasn't just that we were adding a certain mass. It was that we had available to us a pair of chemical scissors that we characterized and could trust to cut at a certain place.
Yeah.
And we knew what it did. It made an aminothiazolidine. And we knew what the mass of the aminothiazolidine was. And we knew what the sequence of the protein was. And so once you, if you don't know how many cysteines there are, you could pretty easily figure it out from what I've already told you.
Yeah.
But once you figure it out, that's the easy part. The difficult part is if it's oxidized, the difficult part is determining which cysteine is hooked to which cysteine. And I realized on the way to a reverse site visit in Washington, D.C., where I think Mike Gross was chairing this site visit, reverse site visit, but I'm not sure. I realized that different pairs of cysteines to form a given a disulfide bond, when subjected to the chemistry that I've told you about with silylation and cleavage, would give a different set of cleavage products that would unambiguously identify which cysteines were connected to one another. I thought it was going to be fabulous. And at that time I had an absolute genius chemistry graduate student, Chinese kid, who could actually speak English. And he was a computer nut. Oh, that was a great story.
So what's the reverse site visit? Well, you got site visits, I understand that, but the reverse site visit is
when you go to Washington and the study section meeting takes place there. So it was one of those situations where we had gotten a bad score. And we were, you know, I don't know quite what the, it was sort of a, not a renewal, but a second chance sort of thing.
Kind of like
a revised application sort of thing.
Yeah, a little slap on the wrist or something kind of deal.
Well, yeah, it was definitely it was better than not, never getting funded again.
Yeah.
And in fact, we did. And in fact, I think this silylation idea really sold them. They really loved it. Oh, so I should tell you about this. So I was having trouble getting funded by writing R01s and having them be reviewed by mass spec-oriented study sections. Because it became pretty clear to me that the mass spec people did not understand the problem of disulfide bond structure. So I complained to the secretary or some hot shit. And he said, well, Jack, why don't you submit your grant and I'll have it go to study section cell B. Well, study section cell B was known to be a real hard-assed group of people, and that rarely funded anything, I guess. And so this study section guy said, fine, so you don't like mass spec people who you think don't understand the project. Send it through me again. I'll see that it gets to a study section heavily populated by protein chemists. Mm-hmm. And we did. And he sent it to them for review. They loved it. And I got very high marks. And I was delighted, of course. I had a new postdoc come in. He fit right in perfectly. We were off roaring. We even got into protein folding with using the same silylation methodology as a sideline. And I brought in a protein folding guy to had some publications. I had six or seven publications, which I thought was pretty decent. And so I put in my final review, my final grant application. I said, I need to renew. And so I decided to go ahead and write up the renewal and send it back to this study section that was so enthralled. And I thought we had a great chance of being funded. And I said to myself, if we get funded, fine, I'll hang on. If we don't get funded, to hell with it, I'll go fishing. Well, it got trashed. It got triaged. This study section that had been so excited had suddenly been repopulated with X-ray crystallographers. And they said, this is not a mass spectrometry problem. This does not require mass spectrometry. X-ray crystallography can handle this. And those X-ray crystallography people, I mean, I have followed their work carefully. They do so much by analogy or by similarity. They'll say, well, the X-ray data will show that this group is analogous to that group, and therefore the disulfide bond has to be this way. And there's no direct proof. It's all by analogy. No hard proof. And they lynched me. And I just said, to hell with it. I'm going fishing.
Well,
so that was the end of that show. So,
well, you can beat your head against a brick wall only so long.
But, you know, I was so happy to find a study section that appreciated what I was doing from an area that I really wasn't expert in, namely proteins. Mm-hmm. And then mass spectrometry was trivial. There was nothing imaginative from the mass spectrometric point of view, which is why the study sections that were mass spec oriented kept turning me down. Because it was just a molecular weight determination.
Sure, yeah.
And with nothing to it. Even though the outcome was...
We're determining something valuable.
Yes, but the mass spec people never appreciated that.
Yeah, well, there are these problems.
But the group had, on that reverse site visit, I remember the review came back and saying that we looked pretty good, and they alluded to what I just told you, and they said it was worded like this: using a clever chemical approach, they've shown a way to elucidate disulfide bond structure. That was wonderful. And this method, it required a lot of wet chemistry. And the wet chemistry required, it was difficult to get the stoichiometry right of the reducing agent, because I had to reduce the existing disulfide bonds to get the mono, or the, I've forgotten the word I used, but you can get, yeah, at least two, what, anyway, oh shit.
So you were talking earlier about something about hydrogen atoms and
Rolando was doing?
No, well, listen, you wanted to talk about the fact that there's a difference between a hydrogen ion and a hydrogen.
Oh, yeah.
What was
okay.
Subtlety? I didn't get that.
Okay, well, do you do any teaching?
No.
Oh. Have you ever taught freshman chemistry?
No.
You ever teach acid-base chemistry to anybody?
No.
You know, it's the... You know, the simple little equilibrium that you write down. HA is the weak acid. And that goes in equilibrium with a H+, hydrogen ion, and the conjugate base, which is the A-.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that H+, is that a proton? Or is that a hydrogen ion? Or is it the same thing?
Yeah, well, it's the same thing.
You mean it's like...
Well...
Like in sodium, there are 13 protons and 15 neutrons in the nucleus.
Uh-huh.
Is one of those 15 protons in the sodium nucleus the same as the H+ in the equilibrium with the weak acid?
No, it's the same as a proton and a hydrogen atom.
Yeah. And that's not the H+. So why do they call this H+ a proton? They'll do that, right? That's what protonates the damn protein.
Yeah.
Formaldehyde.
Yeah. Right.
So, where does that proton come from? Does it come from the nucleus of some atom?
It comes from the hydrogen atom, doesn't it? If you take an electron away from a hydrogen atom, you're going to get a protonated hydrogen. Proton, hydrogen.
Let's say that again.
If you take an electron away from a hydrogen atom,
yeah,
you're going to have a proton and a hydrogen nucleus. A proton.
Yeah. So is that what an acid does when it dissociates?
Who knows?
See, I think we get carried away with our symbolism.
Well, it's quite clearly a possibility.
And because I don't think, see, I sort of like the ionization business, the equilibrium. But you know, the way we talk about it, it could just as well be a proton coming out of the nucleus of any atom. Is a proton.
Yeah.
So, but it makes a wonderful little story, equilibria-wise, to call it H plus.
Yeah.
In the acid-base chemistry that associated therewith.
So this sounds like a philosophical question.
I think you're right. I think you're right. It's almost like the wave duality. I like what you're saying. It's semantics, and philosophy, and the duality of light.
Yeah. Well, I mean, science used to be called natural philosophy, right?
I say again?
Science used to be called natural philosophy.
Oh, I didn't. If I knew that, I'd forgotten it.
Well, these guys, from the early.
Absolutely, like Plato and those guys.
Well, I'm going to like 1700. Even then, Newton's time, he was considered to be something of a natural philosopher. I think all these guys that looked at nature to try and understand it from a rational perspective had what we would call science today. I think they thought of more as natural philosophy, but
I see.
I'm maybe putting words in someone else's mouth.
I think you're tuning into
what they call Naturwissenschaften, right? That's your German scientist.
Yeah.
Naturwissenschaften.
Yeah.
Nature, knowledge, art.
Oh.
The art of the nature of knowledge.
Oh.
And the art of the knowledge of nature.
Oh. Wow. Wow. Well, should we go out and explore the country a little bit?
Yeah, let's take a break and go out in the woods.
Now, how am I going to get out of this thing without breaking something?
Oh, let me just grab it and I'll unclip you and. You are a free man.
Okay, I think I'm going to bleep a lizard again.